of Jewish Women in Pittsburgh section. We are interviewing you on an ongoing project which is called Oral History. My name is Aviva Karev. My partner's name is Mr. Howard Baron. Would you like, please, to tell us your name, your address, and your profession? Thank you.
My name is Asher Oppenheimer, and I live in Pittsburgh, 5533 Beacon Street. It's in Squirrel Hill, and I'm assistant director presently of the Council Care Senior Adult Daycare Centers.
Okay, stop. I do not want to know anything.
In advance?
Anytime, except what's in the archive. He's not speaking to you and me. He's speaking to an archive.
So we have to say it in advance before even when the tape is closed. We have to talk
nothing.
Nothing at all? Why do you think so?
I don't know. Our instructions are nothing that's off, nothing off tape.
My parents started to make preparations to go, and it didn't work out because at that time German Jews didn't want to lose their possessions, and they were so attached to what they had that they didn't want to leave. And also, I think there was a lot of optimism that it's not going to be that bad. In 1936, they threw me out of middle school because I was Jewish. And as a matter of fact, before they threw me out, we were three Jews in our class, and they put all three Jews in the rear corner of the room, and some of the professors called that the Jerusalem Quarter.
What was the city?
That was Karlsruhe in South Germany. I'm dying. My parents were still there, my sister. And at that time they already wanted to leave, but it was difficult. So somehow they made arrangements at least for me to leave, and because I couldn't go to school anymore, and go to then Palestine, where I had already an aunt and her family, and I came to live with them. I was 14 years old then, and I continued to go to school. I finished a public school.
What happened to the family?
And my parents stayed in Germany. My mother passed away, a natural death. And that's an interesting story, really. We had a very influential and well-known uncle here in Pittsburgh, who was the owner of a department store called Kaufman & Bear, Mr. Bear. He was an uncle of my father. And about 6 months before the war, somebody came to him and said, you know, you still have a nephew in Germany. And he didn't even know about it. They were here since the middle of the 1900s. And he right away made some arrangements and brought my father and my sister to Pittsburgh. In the meantime, I was in Palestine, and by the time I was 16, I was already a member of the Haganah underground movement. And then World War II started. In 1942, I joined the British Army. And over a period of time, I was promoted to sergeant, and they needed some German-speaking interpreters, what they call them, translators. So they moved me into a intelligence department of the British Army, and that's where I fought in right in the front line, because in the Western Desert, and then in Sicily, Italy, with the 8th Army. Our job was to interrogate the German prisoners the moment they came in. That was right in the front, because if you didn't interrogate them then, it was too late. They wouldn't talk anymore. Once they were registered, they wouldn't talk anymore. They were pretty arrogant then. That was in 45. I was out of the army. Then I went back to school.
And in
Tel Aviv. And got my high school diploma, which for then was like today having a master's degree. At that time, not too many did masters. Well, by 1948, I didn't get my diploma by then. Then, of course, they called me after into the Israeli army, which in the beginning was almost no army. It was more like everything clandestine in the beginning until...
Clandestine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, clandestine. Until the state was declared, then the army became legal, and later on they sent me to an officer's course in the Israeli army, and I was first in ordnance and transportation. I was a transportation officer, and then during that time I finished my I got my high school diploma. The army then made some arrangements that officers could study in the evening.
Mm-hmm.
Afterwards, that was in 60.
Let me direct you back to Europe first. Just a moment longer. Was there anyone remaining in Europe?
My family? Really not. All my family got out of Germany. I had my grandmother, for instance. She was really the last one to get out. Her son was already in New York, and they took her to a course, which was a concentration camp course in France.
Mm-hmm.
You heard about it.
Yeah, sure.
And while there, my uncle from here bribed some officials, and the course was divided into two parts. One was the French part, and one was the German part. So he bribed some officials, and they smuggled my grandmother from the German part into the French part.
Mm-hmm.
And from there she went to Portugal, they smuggled her out. And she came to the United States, and she lived there with my uncle until she was 96
mm-hmm.
years old.
Mm-hmm.
All my family, they got out of Germany.
Mm-hmm.
My father, we were lucky, my father and my sister, they just left about 4 or 5 months before World War II
mm-hmm.
started. They would have been there.
Mm-hmm.
It would have been... they would have gone to a concentration camp. Now, I had one uncle who was, well, they were very rich in that city, who they left Germany a few weeks before the war, and as soon as the war was over, they went back to Germany. Because they got everything back.
Let me ask you, what business was your immediate family like? Your father?
My father had a shoe, a wholesale business, a big business. And as a matter of fact, going back to when I, as a matter of fact, I was the last one in my class. Who was Jewish, because my father was an officer in the German army in World War I, and therefore we had the privilege to stay 6 months longer, and I had the privilege to be beaten up one time terribly, and my nose was broken, when in the classroom they put up the Stürmer. Now it's Stürmer's. It was a German newspaper. That was
I remember the paper.
Anti-Semitic.
Yes, I know the paper.
And I tore it down, and as a matter of fact, there was a big article about me at one time in a German newspaper in the 50s when I was. And maybe it's not very orderly with the way we're talking, but
okay.
When I go
it's
back
okay.
to
it's
it,
okay.
I was, when I came to Israel, like most Jews at that time, when they came to Palestine and Israel, were very idealistic. And in the 50s, like Ben Gurion, for instance, he didn't want to hear about money from Germany and or any compensations or anything. That was in the beginning. You remember that?
Yes.
So I was against anything, but I was supposed to get some money for interrupting my education. So they, my father from here, he sent in the papers, he sent me to sign, I signed it, and I sent it to him. And he asked for me to get that compensation money for, this is going to take us more than 15 minutes if we go like that.
I'll stop I'll stop you.
What?
You can go.
Okay. And that's an interesting story. There was a big article in the paper about it. You can imagine me, a little boy in a German school, sitting in the back and being called being called the Jerusalem Quarter, that my achievements weren't so good, and at the end of the year, I passed with a condition that if I don't get better next year, I won't get my I won't pass to the next grade.
Yeah.
So when my father sent in those papers in the 50s, and you know the Germans are very orderly, they had all the documents, everything was there. I got denied my schooling that compensation. Because they said that obviously my grades were so bad that I would never have finished getting my diploma, the high school diploma. Luckily, I had already a high school diploma in Israel at that time, so we sent in the high school diploma. They opened the whole case again. They went to some of my professors from that school, middle school, you know, there was middle
school.
They went to them, they were already in their 70s and 80s, and one of those professors was a real nice guy, said, yes, there was a lot of anti-Semitism, And he remembered that they broke my nose and my teeth at the time when I tore down the stoma. And he was the professor that my mother went to the next day and said she wants to complain. And he said to her, Mrs. Oppenheimer, go home and forget about it. Mm-hmm. So that's about that. So going back to my life in Am I still in the army?
You're still in the army, yes. Yes, you just got the... What year was that? What year do you want to talk about in Israel?
Well, let's talk about the highlight of every Israeli in the army. It was the Six-Day War.
Okay.
When I was already an intelligence officer, mm-hmm. And my job was to go through Sinai. We were looking for any signs of chemical warfare and things like this that we can prove to the United Nations. Mm-hmm. But, so I really drove around Sinai, one of the first ones, and we came to the canal, Suez Canal, between the very first ones, right behind the...
You're talking about the 56 campaign or
no,
the
67. That
yeah.
was the the Six-Day War.
I understand.
As a matter of fact, I have some pictures that I can put
add to it,
in the tape.
What did you do during the... what about the 57 event, the 56?
In the 56 campaign, I was a already a transportation officer, mm-hmm. and we used to send out convoys with those ancient vehicles that we had. Mm-hmm. Most of those vehicles, they really belonged to a private citizen, and they were requisitioned for the duration of the war, and of course those roads in the Sinai, they were impossible, but they were better than walking.
Uh-huh.
Also, at that time, the Israeli infantry still walked, which now, of course, is obsolete. Not happening anymore. What else do you want to ask me questions?
No, I don't want to ask you any questions. You're doing so well about the 56 campaign. The only reason I... 56. The reason I popped that in was I was a little surprised you jumped over it.
Okay. Well, I was in 48.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's when the War of Independence was. I was still in the Israeli infantry.
Mm-hmm.
That I was a sergeant then, and I was a platoon sergeant, and we used to go out and fight. That was my... I really only was a fighter in the War of Independence.
Mm-hmm.
Later on, I was what we call in Israel a jobman.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It was necessary.
Mm-hmm. And okay, and then let's get back to the Six-Day War, like you seem to prefer.
Yeah.
You were talking about the intelligence activity. Why was that important? What were you doing?
Well, that part of it that I said that we went through Sinai,
mm-hmm.
Especially left a big impression on me because at that time, that was right after the Sinai was conquered.
Mm-hmm.
All the three main roads in the Sinai were scattered with equipment, no end. We not only did we look for signs of chemical warfare, we also inspected all the Russian equipment that we conquered, and it was, I mean, it was unbelievable, the tens of thousands of vehicles and equipment that they were left behind by the Egyptians. If you remember how the Six-Day War started, it was a surprise attack by the Israeli Air Force that in a matter of hours annihilated the whole Egyptian Air Force, and the war was then already decided because the Egyptians had no
nothing to
Air Force
to protect
speak.
It yes.
Well, if maybe the other Arab countries would have been more togetherness and help between the different armies, they could have maybe defended something, but they could not never have won a war without an air force, and that was maybe a turning point in history when the Israelis understood that if you can eliminate the air force, then you have the war in your pocket.
Mm-hmm.
Now, maybe an interesting point, and it really has nothing to do with me personally, but an interesting point is that at that time, and I'm sure there's no reason not to talk about it now, at a certain point, it came to Israel found out, the Israeli intelligence, that the Egyptians are digging they're erecting underground airfields.
Mm-hmm.
And that was maybe one of the deciding factors that the war could not have been postponed on any longer.
Because they were building bunkers.
Because they were building underground airfields in the desert, with runways and everything. And if they would have put all the airplanes underground, it wouldn't have been possible to eliminate the whole air force. So that was probably one of the factors at the time when Israel decided to go for it.
Go for it at that time. Once more, let me take you back a little bit. As I gather from your remarks, essentially you were living both in Europe and in Israel in a generally secular setting. You didn't have any, or did you have any, what was your religious orientation, your religious education?
Here we go. My parents, they belonged to Reform Synagogue in Germany.
Okay.
Which was, the Reform movement in Germany was founded in the 1900, late 1900. And as a matter of fact, that uncle that I told you about, Mr. Beer, he was one of the founders of the Rodev Shalom Synagogue in Pittsburgh.
Mm-hmm.
But they went already to a Reform Synagogue in my parents in the 30s and maybe 20s.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember during Hitler's time, when there was no beef, kosher beef, or even before, my mother made the pork kosher.
Mm-hmm.
You know what that means.
Mm-hmm.
To put it, you know, to salt it. And so we really, we're completely non-religious anymore. But
there's a big difference between non-religious and Reformed Jew.
Well,
non-Orthodox. Is that what you're trying to say?
Well, I'm trying to say that we were not religious.
Okay,
okay?
I was trying to
Jewish.
Be sure.
We were Jewish, not religious. But there's another point there that at that time my parents, especially my father, also he sent me to Palestine. He would never have gone there.
Mm-hmm.
It was so so unreal for that type of Jews in Germany, the life in Palestine, they didn't even consider it. They were anti-Zionists, and I was the only Zionist in my family.
Were you consciously?
Yes, I was in a Zionist youth organization. Mm.
See, that's the kind of difference that I want to hear.
Yeah.
The distinction.
Yeah, otherwise my father would never have. He wouldn't have. Of course, I remember his portrait when they brought me to the railway station at the time to go, the Wilna airport. To speak of. Everything went by rail.
Yeah.
So he said to me, I'm just happy at least one of us is going out of this Germany, and who knows if we will ever follow. That's what my father said to me at the railway station. And we didn't travel by air then at all. We went on a boat, very nice boat. There were two ships, really, who went from Trieste to Palestine. Mm-hmm. One was called the Jerusalem, and the other one had another name. And they went took about 4 or 5 days to go from Italy to Palestine. Italian ships.
Mm-hmm. What did you say the name was?
Jerusalem. That was one of the ships. Mm-hmm. Hey, let me go back to tell you a story about...
last one.
About the British army. At a certain time, after the war was over, and the concentration camp opened, a lot of Jews came to Italy, poured into Italy and Austria from the east, from the concentration camp, from all over. There were some Jews that hit all during the war. They came from all over into Italy and Austria. I was then working from the British Army for the Sofnut, which was, who the Sofnut was?
Jewish Agency.
Yeah.
Jewish Agency.
Yeah.
Transport Jews from Austria to Italy. And I remember there was one big convoy that I participated in, when we took the Jews from Austria, and the British really closed their eyes. When between Austria and Italy, there's the border up in the Alps, near past Udine, up in the mountains.
I was there last summer. But
there is a beautiful town, a border town between Italy and
Innsbruck?
Austria. Now, Innsbruck is already, it's a small town. I don't remember later. Anyway, that's where we took, there was a convoy of about 30 trucks, and we closed the canvases in the back, they let us through. They knew that the British military police at the border, they knew that they were Jews refugees on those vehicles. They let us through, and we were on our way to a port at the Adriatic coast called La Spezia.
Mm-hmm.
Yes,
La Spezia? Sure, not far.
You too?
Yeah, yes.
Okay. About 20 miles before we came to La Spezia, they stopped us.
Who?
The British military police stopped us. We, first of all, as many as we could let off the vehicles got off, but they caught almost the whole convoy. There was an officer of a Palestinian transportation unit who was in charge of that convoy. They took off his shoes. I was right there. I was right there with him. They took off his shoes and they put him in handcuffs, and they took him to prison. But all in all, they let all the vehicles, after a while, go back to the unit, to that transportation unit, and they let the refugees go on to Spezia.
Mm-hmm.
And the ship was already there waiting for them.
How many, about how many were there? If there were 30 trucks, 10 people each?
I would say more than that.
There were
maybe 20 people on each vehicle. And
that's about 600 people.
It was a big transport.
Mm-hmm.
And they were in bad shape. Many of them were in bad shape. But they were happy.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm glad you digressed and told that little story. It was not a digression. It brought us up to a time which I think we can continue from. So I thank you very much.